Are you aware that Australia and India share a national day, the 26th of January? But where we commemorate, though in a vexed way these days, the arrival of the English, India commemorates their departure. India's 26th of January marks Republic Day, the day in 1950 that India's new constitution was introduced. Now, that difference in our two countries, that we are subjects of the Queen and India is not, is one reason we've not had the close relationship you might expect, given that we once had much in common under British colonial control. Karma McLean is Professor of South Asian and World History at the University of New South Wales, and she's written a work called British India, White Australia, trying to tease out the historic relationship between the two countries, offering some fresh thinking. Welcome to Saturday Extra, Karma.
Thank you very much, Geraldine.
Before we delve into the 20th century, where your focus is in this book, how would you characterise the India-Australia relationship today? I mean, what would you see as the strongest bonds?
Well, I think there's a lot of potential, but very rarely is the potential taken up in the ways that it could be, perhaps. And I think, you know, in some ways, an understanding of history and a reliance of the relationship on what's usually known as three C's, curry, cricket and Commonwealth, is presumed that that will actually carry the burden of the bilateral relationship. And I don't think it's enough. And in fact, I think it does damage.
Why?
Well, if we look at cricket to begin with, it's highly competitive, and it can often be the cause of a lot of dissension rather than togetherness. It's up, you know, one side wins, one side loses. It's not the best way to bilateral relations. I think it is. Yeah, and it's competitive.
And the curry and the Commonwealth.
Well, curry, there's a debate about whether even curry is an Indian word. Curry is arguably more of a British national dish than an Indian one. And the Commonwealth is the one I want to emphasise and what I try to emphasise in this book, because I think the presumption that we share an experience through the British is, you know, only correct to a point. There's actually massive divergence, which you pointed out in the introduction. So I think there is a very different perception in India, and I think, you know, there's a very big difference in our nationalist sentiment. It's an overarching sentiment in India that's, you know, again, built on a very long history of anti-imperialism.
Yes, well, and one big sticking point you make is the White Australia policy that played this critical role in this early part of the 20th century in a different experience. Now, develop that for us, please.
Well, the White Australia policy is something that Australia was, you know, well known in India for. So the period of history I'm looking at is post-1901, so post-federation, and I'm looking at the experiences of India in Australia, but also Australians in India. So it's a little bit, you know, looking at both sides of the coin. And the White Australia policy was very well known in India. There was actually a small number of Indians in Australia. I mean, small but sizable, about 5,000, between 5,000 and 6,000 at the time of federation. And they were conceded rights of residency after 1901, despite the White Australia policy, but no further Indians could arrive. And any further arrivals of Indians were basically precluded after 1901. And the policy it became so well known in India after that, I mean, White Australia was almost the name of the country rather than the name of, or the informal name even, of a policy. And it created a sense of a disruption in the empire. You know, the British liked to create a sense that the empire was, you know, was all equal, although of course it wasn't, and that there was free movement within the empire. And Australia and the other dominions were rather hesitant to accept that idea and, in fact, battled the British on that point.
Sorry to interrupt, but you say the Brits themselves were often critical of Australia's immigration policy, almost embarrassed.
Yeah, very much so. And then they often tried to put pressure on Australia to, you know, remove or tinker with or make it a more hospitable policy for Indians, because Indians themselves challenged the British on the policy, saying, you know, that you claim that there is equality within the empire, but we are not free to move about the empire as we please. And yet all white men are free to move throughout the empire.
And, of course, they were serving in the military, weren't they, for the empire?
They were. Absolutely, yeah.
Extraordinary,
in both
really.
World Wars.
They suffered appallingly in World War II and one, actually. Now, partly because of the famines in 19th and 20th centuries in India, There had been interest there in settling Indian people in the Northern Territory, which I didn't know. How far did that get?
It's funny, it's an idea that's sort of first mooted in the late 19th century as a way of redistributing populations around the world. And the idea is never really taken very seriously. The resistance to Indians settling in Australia is known even before the White Australia policy. And there's always a lot of resistance to it. But it comes up again a number of times in the early 20th century and again in, as late as 1947. Someone is saying, you know, perhaps we can actually use decolonisation as a moment to, you know, redistribute the imperial population and settle parts of the Northern Territory with Indian settlers as a way of populating it after, you know, the war. But, you know, Indians in particular were seen as being, you know, particularly well suited to this because it was a tropical climate, and so it wouldn't be terribly different to the climate that they were used to in India.
And the famines really coloured Australian views of India, didn't they?
Well, they did. I mean, there were very strong imperial drives for famine relief in the 19th century. And, of course, in retrospect, we know that, in fact, it was the imperial economy that created the conditions for these famines. They weren't natural disasters per se. So, you know, in the late 19th century, there were very successful drives, actually, that went through what was the colonies at the time, including Australia, and we donated large, you know, sums towards ameliorating the famine. And this happens again, of course, within the 20th century as well. But the way in which these famines are framed in Australia, as in other dominions, is that India, you know, poor hapless India has these terrible climactic events and we must help, when in fact there was a much larger sort of economic process going on in which the British were actually creating the conditions for famine.
Yes, and this whole business of how we, Australia, your thesis is how we received a lot of these very powerful imageries out of India was brokered through an imperial perspective. I mean, Rudyard Kipling was really the main, one could argue, Australian entree to India in the early 20th century. But Gandhi, when Gandhi arrived, because he really took on the British Empire in his inimitable style, he was pilloried in Australia, you tell me.
Gandhi's hard to understand, and it took a long time for the British to actually understand his method of politics too, because it just didn't operate within realpolitik in the way in which the British understood it. And it was never, I don't think it was ever very clearly explained in Australia. We used to get snippets of news, but never any deep, in-depth explanations of, you know, the politics in which he was engaging over a very long period of time. He returns to India in 1915, is a strong leader until independence in 1947, and then is killed in 1948. But his politics were never well explained in Australia, except to say that he was a threat to the empire, which is a very strong theme in the 1920s, in the context of, you know, we've just finished the First World War and now Gandhi's arcing up and creating all of these problems within the empire. And so there wasn't a lot of sympathy in Australia for that after the First World War. And then again, Gandhi's second wave of politics is in the 1930s, where you start to see a shift in Australian responses.
I'm going to come to that, but I just have to mention the cartoon in your book from Smith's Weekly in 1942 with a very black Gandhi sitting on the ground in front of two white colonial hunters in pith helmets representing the USA and Britain, and there's a large tiger advancing on them with a Japanese flag attached to its tail, and Gandhi is saying in the little caption, "Go away, I want to try my passive resistance on this tiger."
And it's very indicative of the way in which Gandhi's politics were derided as being impractical and just not actually engaging with the real politic of the moment, but often taking, you know, his politics out of context as well.
Look, I'm just going to hop forward because you're sort of saying that there is, starts to be a bit of a shift in that second wave of Gandhi's politics. And there were some key individuals who played a role. Like, you do make the point there were some pro-India groups in Australia pushing for a more respectful understanding, the missionaries and the Theosophical Society, interestingly, and some key individuals. One of them was R.G. Casey, who was assigned as governor of Bengal in the 1940s and, of course, became foreign affairs minister under Menzies. And he had personal relationships, didn't he, with Gandhi and Nehru, who became the first prime minister.
Yes, he did. I mean, so Casey's a fascinating player in India in the 1940s. He's appointed at the end of 1943, arrives in January 1944, and he's only there for 2 years as governor of Bengal. And Bengal at the time is going through one of its biggest famines, in fact. And so he's there at one of the most difficult times. You know, in the larger context of the middle of the Second World War and just prior to decolonisation, when politics about when are the British going to decolonise and how are extremely urgent. And Casey lands right in the middle of that. And he ends up becoming something of a broker between Gandhi and the British at a time when their relationship had broken down. And so he's actually quite interesting. And I think he's one of the first Australians who understands India and has, spent, 2 years watching Indian politics fairly close up. And yes, he's imperial ultimately, but he develops a much more sympathetic understanding of India than I think any other Australian had up until that point. There were a couple of others, but they tended to come from the left of politics. And as we're we're moving into a period which is becoming increasingly defined by anti-communism, they're never able to get much traction. But Casey, as a conservative, is able to get a lot more traction in influencing Australian public opinion about India. And so when he comes back to Australia in 1946, the first thing he does is write a book about his experience in India. And it's more, it actually gives quite a, it's not perfect, but it gives a reasonably sympathetic account of trying to explain India, Gandhi, and why it is that India wants independence, why they don't wish to be part of the empire anymore, which is something that most Australians don't quite get, especially in the context of the Second World War.
Yeah, I must say I've always found Casey very interesting. And, of course, Menzies was always very much stood at odds, shall we say, with Casey. I'm going to conclude about the point that we made in the introduction about India celebrating its Republican birth the same day we celebrate the arrival of our colonist settlers. There's a little anecdote in your book about passports when you were travelling earlier this year. Could you tell it, please?
Yeah, I was actually leaving India and going into Pakistan over the Wagah border for an event in Lahore. And I was travelling with, it sounds almost like a joke, I was travelling with an Indian colleague and a British colleague. And we were asked to deliver over our passports and they compared all of our passports. And then my passport came up and I had Her Majesty the Queen in the front page. And he said to me, you've still got the Queen. What is this? We Indians got rid of them long ago. And, I had to try and explain that we've had a Republican movement in Australia, but it has yet to actually, gain the sufficient traction to change our constitution and for Australia to become a republic. And I was looked at with great pity and sadness by the border security guard. It was quite an interesting moment.
How do you think they're going to come out of the coronavirus? You must be, as a student of India, must be watching with, alarm.
It's really disconcerting. Healthcare in India is not prepared for this, it's going to sweep through.
And, of course, we've got all these Indian students who've been coming to Australia, don't we?
We probably have about 100, I mean, the numbers are not exact, but probably over 100,000 Indian students in Australia. And when the Indian government, nation states, announced, shutdowns with very little warning, and they're unable to go back to India at the moment. And so many of them here are
stranded,
effectively in a form of limbo. And like many people, young people isolated, away from family and friends, in a crisis and in need of, I think a lot of, solidarity from Australians as they face the coming crisis.
Indeed. Okay, Karma McLean, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, Geraldine.
And Karma is Professor of Southeast Asian History and World History at the UNSW. The book is British India, White Australia, and it's published by New South Press.